This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. U.S. President Joe Biden arrived in Mexico City Sunday ahead of 2 days of talks with the leaders of Mexico and Canada. He was welcomed at the airport by his host, President Andres Manuel López Obrador. Immigration is expected to dominate the talks between the North American leaders on Monday and Tuesday. Before flying to Mexico, the U.S. president visited the border between the two countries. Republican Governor Greg Abbott of the U.S. state of Texas said Mr. Biden's visit to his state was for show unless he enforces immigration laws that already exist.
It just so happens he's 2 years and about $20 billion too late. He needs to step up and take swift action, including reimbursing the state of Texas for the money that we spent, but providing more resources for the federal government to do its job.
Newly elected U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is about to face his next big test with a divided House of Representatives that's passing a rules package. Here's Jackie Quinn.
The rules package, generally a routine task at the Capitol, could bring the next showdown for Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who needed an epic 15 ballots and hours of negotiating concessions to get enough support to become Speaker. There could also be trouble brewing on raising the debt ceiling and funding federal programs. Ohio Republican Jim Jordan on Fox News Sunday.
We got a $32 trillion debt. Everything has to be on the table.
But Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries on NBC's Meet the Press says he's concerned the cuts promised to conservatives will go too far.
Undermine the health, the safety, and the well-being of the American people. It may undermine national security.
He says they'll work with the GOP to find common ground where they can. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
For more on these and other stories, visit us at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Russia claims it's carried out a deadly attack on Ukrainian troops, but Kyiv denies anyone died. AP correspondent Mimi Montgomery with more.
The Russian Defense Ministry says its missiles hit two temporary bases housing more than 1,000 Ukrainian troops in Kramatorsk, killing 600 of them. A ministry spokesman says the strikes were retaliation for a recent Ukrainian attack in Makivka, which they claim left 89 Russian soldiers dead. However, Sergei Sherevachi, a spokesperson for Ukraine's forces in the east, told the Associated Press that the Russian strikes on Kramatorsk damaged only civilian infrastructure and that the armed forces of Ukraine were not affected. The Donetsk Regional Administration confirms there were no casualties, but says seven Russian missiles hit Kramatorsk and two more hit Konstantinivka. Among damaged buildings were an educational house and an industrial facility. I'm Mimi Montgomery.
China's military said it had carried out combat drills around Taiwan on Sunday, focused on land strikes and sea assaults, the second such exercises in less than a month. The People's Liberation Army's Eastern Theater Command said in a statement the aim of the exercises was to test joint combat capabilities and, quote, resolutely counter the provocative actions of external forces and Taiwan independence separatist forces, end quote. There was no immediate response from Taiwan, which the Chinese government views as its own territory. Thirty-nine people were killed and more than 100 others injured when two buses crashed in a head-on collision overnight on an arterial road in Senegal's central Kaffrine region. President Macky Sall told reporters Sunday. Sall visited the crash site. The government has announced 3 days of national mourning beginning Monday. The first orbital satellite to set off for space from Western Europe will be launched from Cornwall in southwest England on Monday. Virgin Orbit's CEO Dan Hart told a news conference Sunday they plan to use a modified Boeing 747 with a rocket attached under its wing for the first time outside the company's base in the United States. Here's more from Hart.
The space industry is worth around about £16.5 billion annually to the UK economy and employs 47,000 people, and that's growing. And we are absolutely fantastic at designing satellites and building satellites. You know, I always use the heuristic that we build more satellites here in the UK than anywhere outside of the US.
The mission has been given a window for takeoff Monday morning, but that is dependent on the weather plus other scheduling and system issues. And Virgin Orbit said there are backup dates in mid and late January. From Washington, via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Monday, January 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, tension in Pakistan as authorities order the military to hunt for members of a banned militant group.
We do know that over the last couple of days, there have been, according to the military, specific intelligence-based operations that have killed like about 20 top leaders of the Pakistani Taliban.
The United States and Japan plan strategic talks to counter growing North Korea ballistic missile launches.
The Japan officials will meet their American counterparts, Lloyd Austin and Antony Blinken, for talks on Wednesday. They're expected to focus on their new national security strategies and concerns.
And supporters of former Brazilian president storms Congress, the Supreme Court and Presidential Palace in the capital city of Brasilia. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. The Russian military claims to have carried out deadly missile strikes on Ukrainian troops, but Ukrainian officials deny there were any casualties. The Russian Defense Ministry says its missiles hit two temporary bases in the eastern city of Kramatorsk, with hundreds killed. A spokesman for Ukrainian forces in the east told the Associated Press there were Russian strikes on the city, but that they did not damage any civilian infrastructure, and, quote, the armed forces of Ukraine weren't affected, unquote. A week ago, Ukrainian forces struck a facility in Makhiv, also in the east, killing dozens of Russian forces in one of the deadliest attacks since the war began in February. The United States and Japan will host strategic talks aimed at countering growing North Korean ballistic missile launches and military buildup on the Korean Peninsula. Associated Press correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
Foreign and defense ministers will discuss security the day before Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida lands in the U.S. capital. Kishida meets with President Joe Biden on January 13 for a summit wrapping up his tour of Group of Seven Nations as Tokyo expands its military and deepens its alliance with America. The Japan officials will meet their American counterparts, Lloyd Austin and Antony Blinken, for talks on Wednesday. They're expected to focus on their new national security strategies and concerns, including China, North Korea and Russia. I'm Charles de la Desma.
Authorities in Islamabad have ordered military forces to hunt for members of a banned militant group, the Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan. This as the group, a close ally of the Taliban, who seized power in neighboring Afghanistan in August 2021, announced it has called off a ceasefire with the government and ordered its fighters to carry out attacks across the country. Already, tension has risen in northwestern Pakistan, close to the Afghan border, after the group attacked a patrol vehicle and killed several security officers. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gaul.
Today, there were two or three attacks in the northwestern city of Peshawar in adjoining districts, killing several police officers once again. So the group continues its attacks, but we have not heard of any large-scale operation by the government side or by the military so far. But there are increasing speculations that the government may decide to go after this group in several districts located on the border region. We do know that over the last couple of days, there have been, according to the military, specific intelligence-based operations that have killed like about 20 top leaders of the Pakistani Taliban in the northwestern border regions.
What has been the reaction of the people and their fears in some of these districts that these activities are taking place?
Obviously, this relentless violence has worried Pakistanis, especially after the suicide bombing which took place about a week ago in the capital Islamabad here, killing one police officer and then this Pakistani Taliban group claiming responsibility for launching this attack. And the group also has reportedly sent several more suicide bombers to major cities for carrying out such attacks. So obviously, there are concerns that in coming days, as this group is expanding its activities, not only to the capital, but other parts of Pakistan from their strongholds in the northwestern region, that there may be some major bombing incident. And that's why we see a lot of security being put in place, not only in the capital city, but other major cities of Pakistan. This is what is really worrying the government and the people, that maybe there's going to be some more attacks and major attacks. Obviously, the government is trying to assure the population that they are doing all they can to stop these militants from launching any attacks. And that's why we saw this National Security Committee meeting last week, where the Prime Minister ordered the military to prepare for taking on these militants, no matter how much force is required. But they have to be crushed, according to the Prime Minister's office statement that was issued after the meeting. The crux of that meeting was that the government has decided to engage or re-engage with the Taliban authorities in neighboring Afghanistan, because that's where the Pakistani Taliban are based. And the Taliban government in Afghanistan has repeatedly denied these allegations that they are allowing any group, including the Pakistani Taliban, to operate from their country. Here in Islamabad, the government believes that if the Afghan Taliban do not use force against this group, then obviously that suggests that they are not willing to deliver on their counter-terrorism commitments that the Afghan Taliban have made to the world. And that's why we heard a lot of speculations over the last few days that maybe Pakistani government will go ahead and launch some cross-border airstrikes against the suspected terrorist bases of the TTP in that country.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gao speaking with me from Islamabad. The European Union, the United States and other Western nations have strongly condemned the hanging of two men on Saturday by Iranian authorities. Tehran says the men killed a member of the security forces during nationwide protests that followed the death of 22-year-old Kurdish-Iranian woman Mahsa Amini on September 16th. Freddie Joyner of Reuters reports.
Video that aired on Iranian state television Saturday showed two defendants identified as Mohammed Mehdi Karami and Syed Mohammed Hosseini testifying in court on an unspecified date in December 2022. Both were convicted of killing Ruhollah Ajamian, a member of the besieged paramilitary force militia. Three others have been sentenced to death in the same case, while 11 received prison sentences. Amnesty International said that the court that convicted Karami relied on forced confessions. And Hosseini's lawyer said in a tweet in December that Hosseini had been severely tortured. Iran denies that confessions are extracted under torture. The executions of Karami and Hosseini brings to four the number of protesters officially known to have been executed in the aftermath of the unrest. Amnesty has said Iranian authorities are seeking the death penalty for at least 26 others. The news of the executions brought condemnation from the European Union, the U.S., and others, with British Foreign Minister James Cleverly calling on Iran to, quote, immediately end the violence against its own people.
That's Freddie Joyner of Reuters, and the United Nations Human Rights Office has called on the government of Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko to drop criminal charges against Nobel Peace Prize laureate Ales Balyasky and to immediately free him from detention. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Belarusian laureate Ales Balyasky went on trial at the capital Minsk on charges that human rights activists widely view as bogus. If found guilty, he faces up to 12 years in jail. Two other representatives of his organization, the Vyazna Human Rights Center, also are on trial and could face lengthy prison sentences. UN human rights spokesman Jeremy Lawrence says his office has serious concerns about the conduct of their trial.
The trio are among hundreds detained after a violent crackdown on anti-government protests back in 2020. We call for the charges against them to be dropped and their immediate release from detention.
Balyasky jointly won the 2022 Nobel Peace Prize, along with Russian human rights organization Memorial and the Ukrainian human rights organization Center for Civil Liberties. Balyasky did not attend the award ceremony in October because he was in prison. Lauren says Bialyatsky and his colleagues are being held on charges of financing protests against the government and of violating public order.
I'm not a lawyer, so I can't really go into the technical detail on the laws itself under which they've been charged. Suffice to say that we consider these to be arbitrary arrests, constitute arbitrary detention. The charges simply politically motivated.
Lawrence notes the Human Rights Office and the Special Procedures Unit are closely following the case. He says concerns about widespread gross violations in Belarus have been raised at the Human Rights Council and the UN General Assembly. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has warned that malnutrition rates are growing in Ethiopia's Tigray and Afar regions, despite increased amounts of aid to the embattled areas. In its latest official reports, they said access to provide aid remains difficult in some areas. Maya Masekeo reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Ethiopia says from mid-November through December, more than 3,000 trucks of food, health and shelter aid were sent to Tigray region. In its latest report Thursday, the agency said in the last week of December alone, it assisted 368,000 people in Tigray with food aid, some of which was also sent by air. But the biweekly report said malnutrition rates were alarmingly high, with one-third of children and two-thirds of pregnant and lactating women screened in December found to be acutely malnourished. Despite the Ethiopian government allowing increasing amounts of aid to Tigray since a November peace deal, the UN report said some areas were still out of reach. It said organizations working with the UN had assisted about 60% of 5.4 million people targeted for help in Tigray since October. A UN spokesperson in Ethiopia was not immediately available to comment. Debeba Zode, spokesman for Ethiopia's National Disaster and Risk Management Commission, says they have reached areas other aid groups cannot, including border areas near Eritrea, where they have given food to about 81,000 people. Debeba says food assistance has been given to more than 8 million people in need of support in the northern part of the country, including Tigray, Amhara, and Afar. The November peace deal between Ethiopia's federal government and the Tigray People's Liberation Front ended 2 years of war and lifted aid and services blockades to the region. Ethiopia in December restored water, power, and telecommunications in several towns in the region, as well as commercial flights to the capital, Mekele. While fighting has calmed in Tigray, clashes are being reported in Ethiopia's southern Oromia region. Ethiopia's Oromo and Amhara ethnic groups blame each other for allegedly deadly attacks since November. The UN report said aid access to Oromia region was difficult, with ongoing conflict displacing more people. It said as of December 30, more than 14,000 people fleeing conflict from Oromia arrived in Amhara region. Maya Misaker for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mahmoud has called on young Al-Shabaab fighters, he says, are, quote, brainwashed, unquote, to surrender to the government amid ongoing military offensive against the group. Mohamed Desani reports from Mogadishu, Somalia.
Speaking at a mosque in the country's capital, Mahmoud, who was last year after his election for second time declared an all-out war against the Islamist insurgents, also called on the Al-Shabaab fighters to denounce the terrorist ideology before it is too late. His remarks come after the militant carried out two attacks on government forces in Somalia's central region in 2 days, killing more than 43 people, including senior officers. He said he wants to tell the boys to return from the wrong path they are taking. He urged them to return to their government, to their people, and to their religion. He said every step they take from now on will only increase their guilt. The president's message comes as Somali forces backed by locals continue battling the group. In the total war he declared on the militant, government forces have liberated large swathes of territory from the group, mainly in the south central state of Hirshabelle. Speaking to state-run television in Mogadishu, Somali Prime Minister Hamza Abdi Barre said an investigation is underway into soldiers who were arrested on suspicion of facilitating the Al-Shabaab attack on the Villa Reyes Hotel in Mogadishu in late November. Barre did not say how many soldiers were involved. He says all of the soldiers who were working that day have been arrested and an investigation is currently underway. He says he wants the ongoing investigation to be successful and impartial. The hotel attack claimed by the militant group Al-Shabaab killed at least 13 people, including 5 Al-Shabaab attackers. The popular Villarreis Hotel was located near the presidential palace in Mogadishu and was frequented by senior government and security officials. The Somali government has been fighting Al-Shabaab for more than 15 years. The Islamist group carried out deadly attacks in the Horn of Africa nation, targeting government officials and African Union peacekeepers. Mohamed Daisane for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
And in other news, supporters of former President Jair Bolsonaro, who refused to accept his electoral defeat, have stormed Congress, the Supreme Court, and Presidential Palace in the capital of Brasilia. The action comes a week after the inauguration of his leftist rival, President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Thousands of demonstrators bypassed security barricades, climbed on roofs, broke windows, and invaded all three buildings, which are connected through the vast Three Power Square. Some have called for a military intervention to restore the far-right Bolsonaro to power. TV channel Global News showed protesters roaming the presidential palace, many of them wearing the national yellow and green colors that have come to symbolize the Bolsonaro government. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Junior Dofo in Washington. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration on Friday approved the Alzheimer's drug lecanemab, developed by Elsa and Boygen for patients in the earlier stages of the mind-wasting disease. Emma Jell of Reuters reports.
Thomas Wisniewski is the director of the Alzheimer's Research Center at NYU Langone.
Amyloid beta is a protein that accumulates in Alzheimer's disease, and it specifically forms aggregates, and those aggregates are toxic to neurons, that is, brain cells, and it causes neuronal dysfunction and death that correlates with the cognitive symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, the dementia.
Nearly all previous experimental drugs following the same approach have so far failed. An ISAI trial found that the drug slowed the rate of cognitive decline in patients with early Alzheimer's by 27% compared to a placebo, but nearly 13% of patients treated with Leqembi in the trial had brain swelling.
This form of therapy is not without risks, but in the presented data, it looks like the risks are greatly outweighed by the potential benefits. But nevertheless, the treatment would need to be closely monitored with a clinician who's familiar with this type of therapeutic approach.
ISAI said the drug would launch at an annual price of $26,500. Leqembi was approved under the FDA's accelerated review process, an expedited pathway that speeds access to a drug based on its impact on underlying disease-related biomarkers believed to predict a clinical benefit.
That's Emma Jell of Reuters. And solar panels have mushroomed on rooftops and on the ground in many parts of the world. But they also can be placed on bodies of water. As VOA's chief national correspondent Steve Herman reports, the floating solar technology has taken off on a large scale in Asia and Europe and is now beginning to heat up in North America.
One of the hottest innovations for the non-polluting generation of electricity is floating photovoltaics, or FPV, which involves anchoring solar panels in bodies of water, including lakes, reservoirs, and seas. Floating solar projects are even more attractive when they can be built on bodies of water adjacent to hydropower plants with existing transmission lines. According to Sika Gonzaku, a researcher at the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado.
In countries that depend again on a lot of hydropower, there's concerns around what does power generation look like during droughts, for example. And with climate change, we expect that we'll see more extreme weather events. And so when we're thinking about droughts, there is the opportunity to then have FPV as another renewable energy option in your toolkit, essentially. So instead of depending so much on hydro, now you can use more FPV, reduce your dependence on hydro during like very dry seasons, use your floating photovoltaics.
5,000 solar panels now float on one of the wastewater ponds of the town of Windsor in California, says council member Deborah Fudge.
And they also provide 90% of the power that we need for all of the operations for treating wastewater, for all the operations at our corporation yard, and also for pumping our wastewater to the geysers, which is a geothermal field about 40 miles north.
This lake in Virginia is one of about 25,000 bodies of water in the United States identified by the government as suitable for FPV placement. Floating panels covering one-fourth the area of each of these sites would potentially generate nearly 10% of America's energy needs. Steve Herman, VOA News, at Smith Lake in Stafford, Virginia.
This is Science in a Minute.
A recently discovered comet that is purported to have last visited our astronomical neighborhood some 50,000 years ago may soon be visible with the naked eye or with a pair of binoculars. According to NASA, the comet called C-2022-E3-ZTF was discovered within the orbit of Jupiter in early March 2022. The astronomers who spotted the comet used a wide-field survey camera at the Zwicky Transient Facility at the Palomar Observatory near San Diego, California. The space agency says the comet is now traveling through the inner solar system and should come within 166 million kilometers of the Sun when it reaches its closest point, or perihelion, on January 12th. C-2022-E3-ZTF will be about 42 million kilometers away when it makes its closest approach to Earth, or perigee, on February 12th. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Hi, I'm Kim Lewis, inviting you to listen every week as a panel of VOA and Washington-based journalists discuss the top domestic and international news stories. With our correspondents and sources from the White House, Capitol Hill, and elsewhere, we will bring you the inside stories from Washington. That's Issues in the News every week on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Gino Duffo in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since Burma's military took control of the country in February 2021, the military junta has been leading a campaign of violence against the people of Burma. On December 21st, the United Nations Security Council adopted a resolution calling for the end of violence in Burma, as well as the release of all arbitrarily detained prisoners, including President Win Myint and State Councilor Aung San Suu Kyi. The United States welcomes the resolution, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken in a statement. This is an important step by the Security Council to address the crisis and end the Burma military regime's escalating repression and violence against civilians. Finally, the resolution stressed the importance of the role of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, in forging a peaceful solution to the crisis. Central to ASEAN's plan is the implementation of the five-point consensus, which calls for a constructive dialogue between all parties in the country while also ending violence and increasing humanitarian aid in the region.
It helps answer the call from our ASEAN partners for greater support from the UN and the international community.
However, Ambassador Wood noted, this resolution does not go far enough to hold Burma's military accountable for their crimes.
We should call directly for the regime to face justice for the crimes it has reportedly committed, such as strikes on a school and a concert that kills scores of civilians. We should not overlook the General Assembly's resolution in support of an arms embargo. And we should pursue a mechanism to prevent the flow of financial resources to the regime.
The United States is committed to working with the UN and our international partners, including ASEAN, to end the violence in Burma and seek a peaceful reconciliation to the crisis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.